Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Well, it's feast or famine. We haven't had a book written by a real umpire in how many years? Bruce Weber's As They See Him doesn't count because he was an embedded journalist working on a story. But this year we have two, Doug Harvey's They Called Me God and Al Clark's Called Out But Safe. Clark, an American League umpire from 1976 to 2001, was a really colorful character. Like many who take the time to talk about their profession, he was proud of his craft and worked hard to hone his skills. And he was always grateful for his opportunities and never took anything for granted. And yes, he made a couple of big mistakes along the way. He was fired in 2001 for improperly using plane tickets in violation of the umpire union's contract. And in 2004, he was sentenced to 4 months in jail after participating in a memorabilia scheme which resulted in a federal mail fraud conviction. But Al Clark never shied away from his responsibility or blamed his situation on others. He tells a frank story in his memoir, written with the able assistance of Dan Schlossberg. And here's my conversation with Al Clark.
Al Clark, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Ron, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we haven't had a mainstream umpiring book since Bruce Weber's As They See Him in 2009, and that, although it's a book about umpiring, Weber obviously was not a real umpire. Now we have two. We have Doug Harvey's They Called Me God and your book, Called Out But Safe, A Baseball Umpire's Journey. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Tell me about the significance of the title.
Well, the significance of the title is that there are so many things that happened during the course of my 30 years in baseball. And at the end, I was called out by Major League Baseball. In baseball parlance, I was given my release. In everyday parlance, I was fired. And I go into it in the book explicitly and in detail, not only about what that I was fired by Major League Baseball, but also after that, and I spent a little time incarcerated for a decision that I made, a wrong decision that I made, that I had to pay a price for. But after all that was said and done, I'm pretty good. I'm pretty safe. So the title of the book reflects, I was called out, but I am safe. And I think the title is very well put. And the journey inside the book, the journey of my life to this point, is explored rather well.
Now, since there's an unusual amount of Jewish contact in a book like this, let's turn the book around and work from right to left and start with the epilogue. You say in the epilogue that this was a cathartic exercise. Was that the purpose when you set out to do this?
No, not at all. It turned out to be quite cathartic. As Dan Schlossberg, my co-author, co-writer, the fellow with whom I put this together, Dan did a great job, as a matter of fact. Ron, Dan, the author of 35 baseball books, as I'm sure you know, we taped about 45 hours. Dan had it all transcribed, then pulled it all apart, then put it back together, and then the manuscript part of the book began. It became cathartic as we were going through the tape, and then after it was all done, my goodness gracious, I had the great opportunity to look back over my life, both in baseball and out of it. And not everybody has the opportunity to do that. It became very valuable to me, and I explored certain portions of my life because of what we did and the in-depthness with which we covered my life. And that's why it became quite cathartic.
Now, how did that partnership with Dan develop?
Very interestingly, I had an idea to write a book, but had no idea how to do it. Marty Appel, the former PR director of the Yankees and now a PR person in his own right in New York City, is a friend of mine. I called him and asked him, knowing that he also authored a couple of books, asked him if he was interested in doing something like this with me. He was already involved in a couple of other projects, but suggested Dan, not knowing if he was involved in a project or not. Marty put the two of us together. We met at Foley's in New York, a great baseball Irish bar, and sat down, hammered out a couple of things, decided to go forward, move forward, and the friendship has developed. Like I said, he did a wonderful job putting this thing together. Allowed me to do my thing, and the expertise with which he provided made the book what it is today, and I think it's a pretty good result.
Now, you do have some background in journalism. Your father was a sports writer. You've expressed an interest in writing. Did you ever think to just go it totally solo?
You know, I thought about it a little bit, and as I sat down a time or two to write, well, let me give you an example. I had written a 5-page outline as to what I thought the book would be. Should be. I took that to New York with me, and the professionalism of Dan Schlossberg, he took a look at that, and about a week later he got back to me with a 19-page outline. And obviously from that is what we worked, from which we worked. And, you know, writing a book isn't quite as easy as sitting down at a typewriter or computer and doing it. But my roots in journalism, you're right, Ron, go way deep. My dad was a writer, a sports writer in Trenton, New Jersey for both the Trenton papers, the Trenton Times and the Trentonian. Ended up being sports editor at both papers. And for a while after college, I even wrote for the Trenton Times. I was a stringer. I was a staffer for the Trentonian and a stringer for the Trenton Times at times when I was a young man. Learned how to write. My dad, all through high school, during the summer months, made me read a book per month and write a book report about it. And I think I gained some experience of public speaking that way. He made me stand up and not only recite what I had written, but also talk off the top of my head about the book that I had written. So a lot of the stuff that I've got, the expertise or wherewithal about writing, certainly comes from my dad.
Now, you mentioned the amount of hours that you put in recording for the book. Was Dan there asking you questions, or you just were talking extemporaneously?
Well, a little bit of both. Dan was excellent at getting me to start talking, and then one thing led to another, and we just kept on talking. We spent, well, like I say, 45 hours or so over the course of 13 months putting it together. We got together down here in beautiful Colonial Williamsburg, Virginia, where I live, for a while. I went up to Fairlawn, New Jersey, where he lives, and we spent countless hours on the telephone.
How did you vet your memories? Like for example, in Doug Harvey's book, he talks a lot about events and things that happened to him, but he doesn't really go into detail with names and dates and places, whereas yours is much more exact.
Well, I certainly can't and won't talk for Doug. Doug was kind of a generation in front of me, and my stuff is a little more recent. During the course of my career, I would write down some things that occurred to me and hoping that later in my career something like this might occur, not knowing that it would at the time. But I loved being an umpire. I loved putting on that uniform every day. I lived a dream. I mean, every day I went to work, I put on a big league uniform. And my office was Yankee Stadium and Comiskey Park and Fenway Park and Memorial Stadium. And my name on my hat, that's right. Actually, that's a question in the sports edition of Trivial Pursuit. who was the only person in professional sports ever with his name on his hat. You know, a little twist there, but nonetheless, pretty cool.
Do you miss the fact that, the leagues used to be separate with the umpires?
As an old-time guy, I loved being an American League umpire. I think that as we moved, and for 2 years I worked in both leagues, I enjoyed going to National League parks, but there was a difference. And the difference was that the National League players and coaches and managers didn't know the American League guys as well as the American League guys did, and vice versa. The National League guys coming over to the American League, the career American League guys didn't know the personalities or how guys would work and what they could and couldn't do and how far they could and couldn't go. I think this next generation of umpires, they'll never experience that kind of thing. We as individual leagues umpires had the opportunity to explore cities, get to know people, and became friends with people in, well, the 14 cities in the American League as I did, and those friends became very valuable and lifelong friends to me. And I think going to 30 cities kind of eliminates that process. And for me, that was a very valuable process. I value my friends very much that I've got all around the country.
Now, let's talk about friendship for umpires in baseball. It's often been written that the umpire is the loneliest profession. While teams spend half their time at home, the umpire has no home field. He's always traveling. He can't associate with players. You know, we won't have a drink with them after the game. He won't have, as you put it, a sandwich for lunch with the players. It must be a very demanding and lonely profession.
I think that the overall view, Ron, that's accurate, but you learn that kind of existence as a young man as you go through the minor leagues and, you know, matriculate if you're fortunate enough to get to the big leagues. You learn to live by yourself. You learn to work by yourself. You learn to eat by yourself. I mean, I've had many people say to me, geez, how do you eat so many, you know, meals by yourself? Well, it's not so bad to be by yourself, especially if you like yourself. It's okay. It's okay because that's part of the job, and you work your way into it. The same as I think if someone started to travel like we travel, like umpires travel at 45 or 50, it would be so much more difficult to do than learning how to travel once, you know, through the minor leagues and then getting into the big leagues as a young man. I mean, there's a way to travel. You've got to learn how to travel. You just don't go to the airport and go to get on an airplane. There's getting rental cars. There's checking into and out of hotels. There's going to the airport. There's dealing with people every day. And you learn how to do that. It's a process. You don't just do it.
And the umpires have to do that on their own, right? There's no organizing central spot that arranges everything for them.
That's correct. We, at the time that I was working, we were our own travel agents, so to speak. The only thing that the American League gave to us at the beginning of a month ahead of the month that we were in was a piece of paper with cities and dates on it. Everything else was our responsibility, hotels, cars, airplanes, and our job was to be there. They didn't even put the times of the games on those pieces of paper. It was just our responsibility. Things have changed a little bit since I've left the game. Now all the flights go through a central office in New York. You still get to choose your own flights, but they make the reservations for you. Primarily, they want you to stay in the same hotels and that kind of thing. Things have changed a little bit, progressed a little bit, and I'm sure to some extent that's helpful to the young guys, and maybe even likable to the older fellas. I never necessarily stayed with my entire crew. I mean, these guys were my work partners, not my life's partner, and I didn't have to see them every minute of every day. We saw each other at the office. And the office, of course, is the ballpark. And we got to the ballpark about an hour and a half before a ball game to prepare ourselves for that day's game.
Are the umpiring crews the same every year, or do they switch them up?
Well, the way that it works or has worked is the crew chief usually gets to select his number two man, and then the supervisors of umpires fill out the crews with number three and four men, and that goes primarily by seniority. And they try to do a balancing act as best they can, and for the most part, I think they do a wonderful and magnificent job of equalizing the crews.
But is that, do they change things up every year, or once they pick a crew, they're there for the duration as long as all these guys are still working?
They'll mix and match guys from year to year, especially number three and four men. The number two men will probably stay the same for a number of years.
As you got older in your profession, in your 25th, 26th, 27th year and on, did you ever stop in the middle of a game and say, what the heck am I doing here?
Oh, no. My goodness, I loved being there. Being a part of Major League Baseball and an umpire on the field was magic. It was magic every day. Being involved, being a decision maker, having the responsibility of integrity to uphold our national game, never was cause to say, what am I doing here? If anything, it was counting your blessings that you were there.
Now, as an ex-umpire, I have to ask you what your thoughts are on the new video replay system.
I've got a little different take on it than perhaps a whole lot of other folks. Number one, I think it's a wonderful invention. Number two, I think, and I don't know if you've heard this before, Ron, I think it's going to raise the level of umpiring even higher and better than what it is today. And the reason for that is this. With the high definition of televisions and the amount of cameras all over the field, all over the ballpark, the good umpires are going to get even better because they're going to concentrate, if possible, even a little bit more. As you know, or as we all know, a rising tide rises all ships. And the good umpires are going to be even better than they perhaps were before. And the guys who want to let their minds wander, let's say, they're going to see the good umpires being on top of things even better. And that's going to make them want to be better, too. Let's go back in history a little bit. I came to the big leagues in 1976. I was a member of the generation just after instant replay, stop action, and slow motion became prevalent on the game of the week. And at the time, I remember the older fellas, the more veteran umpires, telling me that at the outset, it was quite intimidating to have instant replay, stop action, and slow motion because those fellows thought that it would show the fallibility of umpires.
Sure.
But quite honestly, the antithesis of that is what actually occurred. It not only showed how right the umpires were, but it also earned them a level of respect that they had never enjoyed before because it showed how right they were, not how wrong they were. And with that process in mind, now with this, with the expansion of replay and how high definition it is, you know, all around the ballpark, I think it's going to raise the level of officiating, of umpiring. It's not going to be detrimental to the guys. I think it's going to be quite helpful to the game.
Well, as you say, the amount of times the umpires are correct in their calls are way, way, way higher than the amount of times they're wrong. And they don't have the benefit of seeing it over again from a different angle. They're there. They have to make a spot-on decision.
That's right. And you know what? The times that they are wrong, the times that they judge something incorrect, it's not eating crow to turn a call around. It's getting it right. And there's nothing wrong with getting it right. Ron, action on the field happens so quickly. The players are so big and so strong for the most part. They throw the ball so hard and they are so fast. The hand-eye coordination that a big league player possesses is, well, you just got to be close to it to see it. It's magnificent. And the human eye sometimes plays tricks on you. And I think that to use this, to use the instant replay, to use the technology is wonderful. I mean, it's there. Why not use it? It's going to make the game better. I don't think it's going to slow the game up at all. I think it's a very good thing.
It'll be interesting to see how the strategy comes into use. At this point, managers are allowed two calls, but if they get one wrong, that's it. And if they do it early in the game, they can't use it, obviously, later in the game when it might make a difference, although you never know when a call will change the tide of a game. I wonder, I know in football, the referee crews are rated after each game. I wonder if this kind of system is going to be used by Major League Baseball to rate umpires now.
I think that's yet to be determined. I think it's too new, and I think also that the rules that are pertaining to what's going on this year might be altered.
It's,
I mean, obviously there's
progress.
Going to be... I'm sorry?
It's certainly a work in progress.
Yes, it's certainly. And in order to get it, I mean, absolutely right, you've got to go through some growing pains. And I think this year is part of that process. But they'll get it right. I've got confidence in the umpiring and some of the people in the commissioner's office that have the best interests of baseball at heart and the umpires, the best interests of the umpires at heart. I think that they'll work it out and they'll get it right. And like you say, it's a work in progress. But it won't take long.
I want to talk about the chapter where you discuss your incarceration. How difficult was that to do, that chapter?
How difficult was it to do? It was much more difficult to do the time than it was to do the chapter.
I imagine.
You know, I was very fortunate. I am very fortunate. I'm a very optimistic person, Ron. As difficult as it was, as it all came down, once I got there and once I became a little bit acclimated to my situation and surroundings, I tried to turn a negative into a positive. And I think I did that very well while incarcerated, to the extent that I did a lot of learning, I did a lot of writing, I did a lot of soul searching. I did a lot of stuff that made me think about the time that I was there. I learned, for example, that time is just time. It doesn't go fast, nor does it go slow. It's just constant. I learned about patience. I learned that no matter what I do or how I do it, it's just going to be occurring. I created a situation there. I was in the federal prison in a camp setting where they had an intramural program. I went to the camp director and suggested an officials course. And for 5 weeks, I guess, or 5 or 6 weeks, I ran three times a week an officials course with other inmates. And we actually went out on a basketball court and a softball field. And I instructed about 30, 35 guys how to officiate, with hopes, of course, that when they did get out, when they did have their time served, they would go out and, you know, perhaps become amateur officials and give back to their community to some extent and earn a couple of bucks doing so. So, I'd have skull sessions with guys. Not everybody that's incarcerated is a bad person. Sometimes some guys just made mistakes, and they're doing their time. They're paying the price of that mistake. And I kind of place myself in that category. I know this, that the 4 months, 120 days that I spent incarcerated certainly does not define who Al Clark is. And it's just part of who I am. It was a learning process. I say that... I hope that my friends and family only live that part of my life or that part vicariously through me, as opposed to someone who couldn't handle it. I'm glad it did happen to me because I know I could handle it, turn the page, and move on as I have.
I want to. That's a very moving passage there. I hate to move on in this sense, but the cover of the book. How did you decide on that particular picture where you're ejecting Cal Ripken Jr.?
The cover of the book. I love the picture, not necessarily because it's Cal, but because it shows an umpire doing what an umpire does with tremendous passion, with being a part of the game, with upholding the integrity in the game, and the sincerity with which an umpire works. It just happens to be me in that picture, but there are thousands of pictures of umpires like that. There isn't an umpire in the big leagues, the minor leagues, or probably even amateur baseball that doesn't care about the game. And my goodness gracious, that picture certainly shows passion and care and intensity and everything that an umpire does, you know, in a game, to officiate a game.
Now, as you say in the book, the players don't have to be there. The umpires have to be there.
Yeah, and that's a kind of a line that we use, you know, to tell a player, you know, where is your value? You know, you can argue with me, and you can get yourself ejected from a ball game, but are you of more value on the field or in the clubhouse after being ejected? So many times, you know, young players especially, they have the idea that the umpire is the enemy. Well, the umpire is not the enemy. That club in the other dugout is the enemy. He's the guy who's trying to beat you. All I'm doing is trying to do as best job I can by officiating the game. We certainly can't leave it on your honor, and that's why I'm there.
Did you notice a change in demeanors and in the players since when you came onto the game and since you've left and the players today? Is there like a different type of mentality among the players?
That's a great question, Ron. Yeah, there is, in my estimation. When I was a young umpire and through my career, players had a sense of history of the game, and they worked hard in the game. Now, I'm not saying the players today don't work hard, because obviously and of course they do. But the sense of history in the game by today's players, I don't believe is as intense or well-rounded as it was in the time that I was umpiring in before. For instance, I'd venture to say, and I know this to be a fact, that some of today's players don't have the sense and don't have the reality of knowing what Jackie Robinson did for our game. And I think a lot of that has to do with the money that people are earning today. You know, you give a kid 22, 23 years old, $4 or $5 or $6 or $7 million a year, that's an aphrodisiac that is tough to overcome with reading about the game that you're in. And I think that has caused, you know, a difference, the mentality of the game. The game itself is the same, is the absolute same game. It's just the mentality in the game is different. You know, there's still three strikes and four balls, and you walk the first base, you strike out, fairs and fouls, outs and safes. That's all the same. But I think the mentality, because of the money, has changed the attitude in the game.
There is, as I said before, an unusual amount of Yiddishkeit, of Jewishness in the book. What was your decision in including all that?
Well, I'm proud of my heritage, of course. I think that being the first and only ever Jewish umpire hired by the American League is quite significant. I'm proud of that. There have been National League umpires that were Jewish. Dolly Stark, Stan Landis, Al Foreman, to name just a few. But I was the only guy in the American League that was hired by the American League. Now, why is that? I have no idea. No idea. But I'm proud of that. I'm proud of my heritage. I don't know. It's just part of me. And if I'm going to write a book about me, I'm going to include that, and I'm going to make it a part of it. I don't know if it's a significant part, but it's certainly a part of it, and it's part of me, and I'm proud of it.
Do you miss umpiring?
I miss the umpiring for sure. I like I say, I loved the actual spark of umpiring. I loved being with my partners and talking about our game. I loved preparing for the game an hour and a half before the game. I loved talking about the game over lunch, not necessarily the game that we were at or the city that we were in, but watching, you know, perhaps SportsCenter or, you know, whatever TV was on and reading about it in the newspapers and talking about our game wholly. I don't miss the traveling, not at all. I do miss the friends that I gained all over the country. I miss the big checks, of course, that come with the actual work. But the actual the politics involved in the some of the bull that happens on the field, I don't miss that at all, and certainly don't miss the traveling.
The book is called Called Out But Safe, A Baseball Umpire's Journey, written with Dan Schlossberg. We've been talking with Al Clark. Al, thank you very much.
Ron, you're certainly welcome. I appreciate the time to be with you.
And that does it for another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. Tune in again next time when our guest will be Jonathan Eig, author of Luckiest Man, The Life and Death of Lou Gehrig, and Opening Day, the story of Jackie Robinson's first season. Both of these books are included in 501 Baseball Books Fans Must Read Before They Die, available through Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, and hopefully your local book dealer. And remember to visit Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf regularly. Remember, we have a new book week giveaway. Be the fifth commenter to leave a remark on any topic from the Baseball Bookshelf, and you can win. You get a book, and I get to clean up the house. So there's that. So thanks again, everybody, and we'll see you soon.
That fader so grand, he'd have said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.